there's different kinds of knowledge. And we're in an era where, for the first time, our younger people have more of a specific kind of knowledge than our older people. And that's, you know, the area of digital knowledge. And it's not that older people can't learn technology. That's also a horrible stereotype. We've been using technology longer than the Gen Zs have been alive.
Welcome to Be More, a podcast by Peakon. This is where everyone at an organization can hear different and meaningful perspectives on how we can all thrive in this ever-changing and constantly evolving world of work. I'm your host, Patrick Cornoyer. There are five generations in the workplace today, and all of them have different expectations and needs. Deloitte estimates that approximately 75% of the workforce in 2025 will be millennials, and that's only 4 short years away. Some people feel that the younger generations have higher expectations of their organizations, and some feel that these younger generations have growing, unrealistic demands. But I challenge that assumption. Businesses are growing and adapting at a pace that has never been seen before, and employee expectations are moving at that same pace. We need to keep up, and a lot of organizations simply need to do better. Megan Gerhart has spent over a decade studying generations at work. She is a professor of management and leadership at Miami University and is so passionate about this work that she has authored a soon-to-be-released book titled Gentelligence: The Revolutionary Approach to Leading an Intergenerational Workforce. Megan, thank you for joining the conversation today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we've got a lot to talk about. And a good place to start is to hear from you. What has inspired you to dedicate your work to understanding generations in the workforce for over a decade?
Well, there's a story that starts all of this off. It was over a decade ago now, as you said, about 11 years ago. I was in my office here at Miami University, and I got a knock on my door from our dean's office, who had gotten a phone call from a company coming to campus to do their annual conference. And they were really interested in finding someone that could speak to them about how to manage multiple generations in the workplace. Specifically, if you remember at the time, it was all about the millennials, right? Those millennials with the capital making everyone pull their hair out in the workplace. And so I had been doing research on individual differences at the time, a lot of things around individual differences in leadership, but not specifically generations. But I was also relatively young at the time for, you know, a faculty member. And so I think there was also a little bit of that playing into them choosing my door to knock on. She does this kind of work and she must know something about this. So I'm a Gen Xer, which is not really young, comparatively speaking now, as you said, to the fact that we have 5 generations. X is kind of right in the middle. And so I went over, I did some reading up, I went over and did the talk, and I was just fascinated by the narrative that was going on in this conference room between, really, it was mostly baby boomer managers of varying ages, really frustrated and a very negative conversation about what was wrong with kids these days, quote unquote, which is an age old question. I think it is not a new question, but the millennials certainly amplified the question for many of us. As somebody who worked every single day with millennials in the classroom for, you know, the entire period of time they were at university, and then now our Generation Z, I realized that my perspective and experience on the potential and the perspectives of our younger generation seemed to be really different than what I was hearing from managers. And so I felt this was an opportunity to narrate this conversation differently. There's a lot of sort of sensationalistic headlines. I'm sure you've seen some clickbait out there, really falling into the generational stereotypes. And rather than taking that road, I became really passionate about helping people understand how generations are a really important kind of diversity in the workplace. And by taking what we know about best practices in HR around managing diversity, as well as cross-cultural management, to this new demographic, you know, group, this new idea of generational differences being a form of diversity, I really felt like we could do something that was a lot more smart and approach this conversation in a way that was grounded in best practices, in research, and really look at generational differences as an opportunity. And I realized that I was passionate about it because that is what I do. Maybe because I am a Gen Xer, a member of that sandwich generation between the boomers and the millennials, I always look both directions for guidance, for learning from people who've been here a lot longer than I have, but also from those who are younger, who look at things differently, have different kinds of knowledge and experience. And my career has really been benefited by the wisdom I've gotten from both sides. And I realized that was fairly uncommon as a perspective. And I think that's made me very passionate about developing Gentelligence.
So let's talk a bit about that concept of Gentelligence and the challenges that managers have today or people leaders have today. To your point earlier, there is this, perhaps this perception of younger generations in the workforce demands or expecting a lot. And as I said, I don't really buy into that, to be honest with you. I think that there are high expectations, but I think there's high expectations of everything right now, of business, in the world, just in life, expectations have just increased in general. What is presenting a challenge right now for people leaders with managing younger generations, but also with managing five generations, potentially on one team, you could have five generations that a people leader has to lead in an effective way. What are some of the biggest challenges that you see right now with people leaders?
I think our leadership is getting it from every direction now in terms of the challenges. I would have said that a year ago, and I obviously it's just exponentially more complicated now. But I think we can look at demographic trends beyond just five generations in the workforce. Our baby boomers are, you know, set to retire in, you know, droves. We don't know how the recession and COVID will impact that. But at least when we look specifically in the US, where the official retirement age is 65, and that's slipping away quickly as an accepted retirement age or an age anyone even wants to retire. But by, you know, the next, I think it's 10 years, we'll have all of our baby boomers eligible for retirement. And so one challenge for leadership is all of that organizational knowledge is going to leave, right? All of that experience, those decades of sort of accumulating a specific kind of knowledge, really, we may lose it if we're not careful. And so I think on the latter ends, people in the latter phases of their career, how do we keep those individuals fully engaged as long as they want to be? You know, we need to look at whether or not we are maybe unconsciously ramping down sort of the involvement or engagement of people in latter phases of their career, especially now. A lot of people who maybe were contemplating retirement in the next 5 years might have decided they're done and this is too challenging and stressful and they're just going to go ahead and retire now. What do we want to do about that? How do we make sure that that knowledge is passed down to the people that are going to take over when our boomers do decide to leave? You know, we have some interesting dynamics in the middle of our generational timeline where Gen Xers always, you know, wrapped with that reputation of being slackers, which obviously is not true for all of us. I got to stand up for the Gen Xers, but not viewing upward mobility maybe with the same sort of intensity as millennials or boomers. A lot of those perceptions have caused an interesting flip in the fact that we're seeing millennials leapfrog over our Gen Xers. And that means that we're having a good percentage, our book found stats of close to 40% of people will be led by someone younger than them. That kind of apple cart upset situation is definitely creating an interesting dynamic on both ends. How do I deal with being led by someone younger than myself? What do I think about that? Is that okay with me? Do I sort of resent it? Do I feel like I'm still appreciated for the value I bring to my team as an older team member? And then for those younger leaders who now are millennials are, you know, the oldest millennials are 40 this year. So we have to stop using that word millennial to refer to young, you know, our youngest people, because that's not an accurate term anymore. I mean, they're young, relatively speaking, but, you know, many of them are in management and leadership positions, of course. And so when they are posed with leading people older than themselves, how do they get the respect that they need or they deserve? How do they make sure they are leading effectively and taking advantage of all of the assets that they have on their team? And then, of course, our Gen Zs starting their careers in the midst of COVID. We're seeing here at university level a lot of young people who are losing internships and first job offers. They're obviously sometimes the first to be cut. And those who are lucky enough to retain them, how do you onboard someone into a culture when you can't ever step foot in the door? And that, you know, I think we're going to get to that a little bit later today, but that's creating a really interesting challenge around, you know, recruitment and training and all of those different things. So I think there's a lot of trends going on right now that make Gentelligence even more, I think, important to understand, because there's threat, but there's opportunity and threat if you look for it.
You mentioned earlier about how organizations need to gather the knowledge from the baby boomer generation before they retire and make sure that they capture all of that institutional experience, knowledge, because it's a fundamental part of their organization and the successful operation of their organization in many cases. How would you specifically suggest companies successfully do that? Have you seen programs or approaches that have been very productive and successful to be able to gather that knowledge?
We did a lot of interviews when we did research for the book on companies that we thought had fascinating either just business ideas and models around generational diversity or programs that we really thought stood out for their ability to do this. And I think it goes back to something you hinted at in the earlier question, which is a lot of conflict and a lot of the roadblocks that we see that prevent us from, you know, leveraging generational differences and diversity are assumptions. So assumptions that our younger generations are entitled. So by definition, expecting things they don't deserve yet. Or on the flip side, a stereotype or a bias that our older generations are out of touch or don't understand technology, or insert your, you know, your stereotype here. I think one of the most powerful things we've found in our work is that you really have to take it back to, first, a point of commonality, right? So anytime you're talking about diversity, you have to absolutely appreciate the differences and the power in those differences. And you also appreciate the ways in which people are similar and ways that matter. So in terms of generational differences, there are certainly behaviors, attitudes, values, things that research has found definitely differ in frequency across generations. But then maybe more importantly, there are also values that are similar across generations. So for example, Gene Twenge's work on this has brought this into the forefront several years ago, but we all want to do work that we believe is meaningful and important. We all want to feel respected at work. We all want to feel connected at work. So that's just a sampling of some of the values that are found across generations. Where it gets tricky and difficult is that the way in which different generations express those values is going to look different based on when they grew up, the norms growing up, parental, you know, practices, what it meant to be an employee, what it meant, you know, in terms of a social contract with the people at work. And so for a, you know, Gen Z or a millennial entering the workplace who wants to be respected or wants to do something that's meaningful, that might result in them going into their boss's office or sending their boss an email with a proposal of this great idea on how we could totally rework this program or this system or this practice. And that might be perceived as entitled by someone 20 or 30 years older who never would have emailed their boss with that. You know, they wouldn't have had the audacity to think their boss wanted to hear an idea from somebody who's been there a year. But that is, you know, really falling into this sort of almost ethnocentric, right? The way I look at it is the correct way lens that causes us problems with all kinds of diversity. So one of our practices in the book, we have four different practices, is adjust the lens, right? So instead of looking at just the behavior, you need to dig deeper into what's the value that's probably behind that behavior. So if I understand that one of my millennial or Gen Z employees is trying to do something they think is going to be meaningful and important and helpful to the organization, I'm much more willing to be open to that. I might not agree with the way in which they do it, and maybe that becomes a coachable moment about organizational norms or why things are done in a particular way. But I'm much less likely to automatically assume it's due to entitlement, right? A lot of the work I've done, I find that what older generations view as entitled, younger generations often view as proactive, right? It just depends on where you're standing. Potato, potato, right? And so per your question about how do we make sure that organizations don't lose all of this knowledge, I think it's a two-way street. I have not found any of the younger generations I've worked with to not want advice or knowledge or mentoring or, you know, input. I've found that they're hungry for that. I think there's a lot of evidence that our millennials specifically want one-on-one coaching. They want mentorship. They want wisdom and advice. And actually, they don't really want it from Gen X. They want it from the boomers because they're at the top, right? And so that's the shortest direction to success, is to go, you know, the shortest path from point A to point B. They would love that kind of guidance and mentoring. But the other piece of that is they're not so likely to listen unless they feel there's some sort of mutual respect. So if I'm willing to listen to them and understand where they're coming from and, it, you know, have a conversation about their ideas, I find that almost always that's reciprocated with a willingness and an interest to then hear my input or advice. So I can acknowledge and say, I love that you brought this idea to me. I love that you're so passionate about helping. I want to walk you through some concerns I have. You know, here's why we do it this way, right? Helping them ground their enthusiasm, their passion, their innovation in our organizational culture and history. So it's not that we just randomly decided to do this way. We do it this way for these reasons. So given that, what impact would that make on your suggestion, right? Or, you know, if you have this wonderful desire to advance in the organization, that's great. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about some things I need you to hear and understand that might become a challenge in you doing that as quickly as you want. And it becomes a conversation instead of a sort of dismissal. And it allows me to pass my knowledge and wisdom on in a way that's actually heard. So I think it really comes down to understanding that every generation has something to teach and something to learn, rather than kind of getting at this adversarial, you know, us versus them. That's not how we do it here. Younger people feeling like, well, they're out of touch and they don't understand the new way things need to happen. Okay, boomer, right? It's none of that is productive. So I think cultures where age diversity is respected in both directions come up with the best programs, per your question, whether that's mutual mentoring, which is a term I like better than reverse mentoring. Reverse mentoring, I think by definition, our editor pointed this out to us. We have this great editor who worked with us on the book. And she said, isn't reverse mentoring like non-gentelligent? It assumes that like the way mentoring should happen is from older to younger. And if it happens the other direction, that that's backwards, which was such a great call out. And so we changed it in the book and we made the argument that we should expect mentoring in all directions because generations have different kinds of knowledge to share.
We've been looking at our data set at Peakon from a generational perspective, and your point around mutual mentorship is quite an interesting one. This idea that people can learn in both directions, I think, is quite a powerful one, because you're right. Mentorship programs classically have been focused on a downwards flow of learning, knowledge imparting, and value in a lot of ways, where it's, well, the older, quote unquote, older generation is going to provide the value in the mentorship to the younger generation. But it's a super valid point that it absolutely does go both ways. And we published an employee expectations report at the beginning of the year and have since been continuing to look at employee expectations in the current situation with the pandemic and how it's impacted employee expectations. And all generations in the workforce have clear expectations, have their voice prominent in their organizations. But we do find that the younger generations have increasing expectations around individual growth, individual development plans. To your point, how they proactively are impacting the organization, how their individual work effort is supporting the larger organizational goals and success of a company. When you were doing your research for the book, did you find that there was also, or did you find similar results that younger generations really wanted to understand their individual impact on business success, but at the same time, how they were going to be growing almost every month, like a constant need and ability to grow and to do something different, and not just once a year knowing what they're doing to impact the business, but literally if they could understand every day what they're doing to impact the business, that is a point of inspiration for them. Did you find that when you were doing your research?
We did. I don't know if we were quite that explicit about the individualism component, but I think one of the things that's really fascinating about generational differences is, you know, there's a story behind every generation, right? And of course, we're generalizing a bit because we're talking about people born within, you know, 15 to 19 years of each other. But we do see it coincide with things like, you know, formative events is what we call it. So what was going on socially, politically, culturally, economically that might have changed the way people view, for example, work and their place in work and why you work. I love the stories behind it, right? I'm working on a piece right now about our what we call the silent generation. So the generation that was 1925 to 1945. And the idea is they just sort of took what got thrown at them, right? It was the Depression and it was World War II. Here in the US, we saw, you know, a number of just things pounding on that generation. And of course, there's definitely cultural differences to acknowledge there. But, you know, and they just rolled with it. They were resilient, but very hardworking, conservative, and they didn't really expect that work was there to give them meaning. It was there to feed their family and put a roof over their head. And it was a survival tool, right? It wasn't to give their life, you know, some sort of in-depth purpose. And that's evolved a lot as our options for employment have gone up, our educational levels have gone up. So there's a story behind why our younger generations have that mentality. And it's not right or wrong. It just is. You know, when I started doing this work with primarily baby boomer managers, they were tearing out their hair. And what was really fascinating was their children were the same age as the employees that were frustrating them. And so I had to kind of call the question and say, you know, you can't really, like, how many times a day do you talk to your kids? How involved are you in their life? Like, how much do you know about the decisions that they're making? And a lot, right? And so just as they were, you know, raising millennials with this very strong sense of self-esteem, our baby boomers were a generation that had overall a lot of career success, and they invested a lot in their children. They invested in developing them and educating them and giving them opportunities that maybe the boomers didn't have or their parents didn't have. So coming from a really, really good place. But when you grow up with that much investment and attention in what you need and what you should have in order to thrive, that doesn't go away when you go and get a job, right? Or when you come to the university. When you were highly scheduled and so much attention was given, like, has Patrick had enough foreign language? And should he have an extra year on the Little League championship team? And, you know, all of these things that increased the pressure and the competition and the expectations for our millennials, they brought those with them, as you would expect. You know, children became really the center of the family unit. And so that does create the sort of, what is this going to mean for my development? How will I be benefiting from what's happening here? Am I making the right choice? I think, you know, investment in them was very high, but expectations for them were very high. And so employers have responded. This is where leadership rotational programs came from. Those came out of, you know, nowhere about a decade ago, where suddenly, you know, people right out of school were getting leadership rotations where they were, you know, going through the different departments or areas on some schedule, just so we could tell our millennial recruits, yes, in 3 years, you will be ready to be a manager because we have this program that will make sure it's so. That did create an issue for older employees who maybe have been, you know, biding their time or trying to pay their dues with hopes they would get to a management position. And then this leapfrogging started to occur. I hear from a lot of people mid-career who say, well, somehow I got jumped over because there wasn't a leadership rotational program when I started. So I think it's all about really understanding that saying, well, you're going to do this because that's how we do it here, isn't going to be sufficient for our younger generations. They really want to know why. It's not that they're lazy. I've pushed back all along. I feel that is completely incorrect stereotype about millennials and about Gen Z. I find them to be very driven, as long as they understand the purpose of what they're doing and feel like it has meaning. The other part of this that's really important to acknowledge is we're getting employees who actually are much further along in their experience and development than Gen Xers and boomers were when they started. So when you think about the fact that your average university student has had an internship, and at least, you know, where I teach, that's sometimes two or three summers of internship. It just keeps growing before they even step foot, you know, as an employee. They have had a lot of client experience. They have had maybe job shadowing. They've, you know, gone through a lot of development and things, and really have had a lot more development and experience than most of us had when we started. So they are a little bit ahead of the curve. And just because it wasn't done that way for us is not a valid reason to say, well, we don't do it like that here. I think it has to be a balance. I'm not saying throw away the way everything is done in an organization. It becomes a willingness to step back and say, well, what is done here in a particular way because it's important and it's part of our culture and we've thought about it and it matters? And what's done a certain way just because we've always done it that way? What could be improved? You know, are we losing anything by allowing people to advance more quickly or have a more primary role early on? There's different kinds of knowledge. And we're in an era where, for the first time, our younger people have more of a specific kind of knowledge than our older people. And that's, you know, the area of digital knowledge. And it's not that older people can't learn technology. That's also a horrible stereotype. We've been using technology longer than the Gen Zs have been alive, but we don't learn it as quickly. It's not as second nature to us as it is to younger generations. And therefore, there are certain kinds of knowledge where actually our younger generations have the upper hand. And instead of viewing that as threatening, why not view that as an amazing thing that we could use as an advantage? And so while older generations have a lot of different kinds of knowledge, we talk about this in the book, in terms of the things like knowing why we do things a certain way or our history or our context or those kinds of experiences, I think just because millennials and Gen Z maybe have more expectations, that doesn't mean they're wrong to have them. And it doesn't mean it's necessarily wrong to see what we can do to align with some of those expectations and then coach around maybe others that aren't realistic. I think there's a middle ground.
That's very good advice. And you mentioned, as you were doing your research, that you were quite interested in the silent generation. And as we were doing the employee expectations report, there was one point that I think you would find interesting around the silent generation. We looked at the discussion around well-being. And we know right now that employee well-being is top priority for organizations, as it should be, from mental health to physical well-being. And when we looked at the data, understanding generations and the discussion around well-being, millennials, we saw an increase in the beginning of the year. We saw an increase of just over 20% in conversation around well-being with millennials. With the silent generation, it was 19%. So both generations were talking more about well-being. And that is a pretty amazing connection point to put somebody from the silent generation in the workforce with a millennial and have a discussion about well-being, because it's important to both generations. And the increase in conversation around well-being was pretty much the same between both. And I think it would be very interesting for organizations to have those two generations sit down and talk about what well-being means, how it impacts them, and how important it is to them from two very different perspectives around well-being. Because as you said, silent generation has been incredibly resilient through many different phases of the world and society. And millennials, in comparison, really have not been through the same type of quote-unquote life that somebody in the silent generation has gone through. So I think that'd be an interesting opportunity for organizations to consider.
Oh, count me in. I would love to be a fly on the wall in that conversation. When I think about how socially acceptable it has become for people to talk about well-being or struggles with their well-being, you know, I don't think we're quite to the point where people feel like it's always socially acceptable to talk about mental health, but certainly much more so than it used to be, workplace or otherwise, thankfully. But I think for our silent generation, and to some extent our baby boomers, you know, that wasn't something you talked about. That wasn't something that you shared. That wasn't something that even if you needed, you know, support or you weren't doing very well, you know, that wasn't something we talked about at work or we even talked about publicly. And so now, you know, millennials and Gen Zs are much more open, right? About, you know, I have students who are very open about how they're doing. I check in with them every couple of weeks just, you know, because things are so crazy right now. And thankfully, they're a little bit more willing to let us know or reach out. But this latest piece I'm working on, the silent generation, you know, how has all this isolation that is necessary for physical health impacted mental health? And will our silent generation, our older baby boomers, will they get the support that they need? Will they be willing to, you know, express what they need as opposed to sort of saying, well, this is what we're supposed to do. So we'll be, you know, we'll, again, that's where the silent generation nickname came from, was sort of the fact that they didn't complain. And there's a really fascinating Time magazine article from 1951 that I'm pulling from for this piece I'm doing that basically says, you know, they were asked to, you know, do all of these really hard things and they just kind of put their nose down and did it. And so we're asking them again, right, to isolate and do all these things. And what I found really extraordinary was even among that generation, you know, their greatest concern for well-being was for their kids and their grandkids, and that they wanted to help. They wanted to help support them or help with childcare or remote schooling or, you know, see them and try to be emotional support for them. And they physically were being prohibited from doing that because of lockdown and things like that. So I agree. I think that would be a really fascinating conversation on resiliency and, you know, just how that's impacting every generation right now.
So you mentioned this world that we're living in now, which is obviously a very detached world from organizations are struggling right now with a detached workforce. For the foreseeable future, we will have people working in non-office environments, and many organizations, probably the majority of organizations around the world, are going to need to incorporate some sort of a new flexible working perspective and remote working. And that has a definite impact on younger generations, well, all the generations, but to talk specifically about Gen Z as an example, because Gen Z has been known and is the, or has been the result of a highly social life. And if we look at the past 20, 25 years, the availability to human connection has been increased probably 10 times than it was 50 years ago. Many of the Gen Z population within the work environment thrives interpersonal connection, being together, gains energy from social interaction. That's a bit of a generalization, and I'm not saying that every Gen Z falls into that category, but many do. Now we are in this world of remote work, people not being able to go into offices and not have that social connection. What have you seen with specifically Gen Z struggling in this area, and how can we help organizations connect Gen Z to their cultures, their values, the energy of their organization while they're forced to be detached?
Yeah, this is one where I think we really, really had it wrong. And it's a great example of how we do have to be careful with some of the conclusions we draw. So last fall, the New York Times came out with this piece called Young People Will Save Us All from Office Life. And I loved it. I thought it was great. It talked about how young people view work as a thing, not a place. That was the best quote, I think, from that article. And I thought that's so true, because with technology, with social media, we don't, none of us just work, well, obviously not now, but even then, don't just work for set hours or in a specific place. And a lot of organizations were feeling a pushback from younger people who didn't understand why so much of work was expected to be done at a desk in an office. And I did coaching sessions with, you know, people in their mid-20s saying, I don't understand. My boss wants me to do it at my desk and I don't work very effectively at my desk. It's too noisy or too many people interrupt me. And so, you know, we were seeing some clash about, you know, what does it mean to get work done? You know, do you actually get more done in the office or not? And what sort of artifacts or assumptions are we making about what it means to work at home? And so many sort of trends and things pointed to the fact that our younger generations wanted more remote work opportunities, that they didn't want to have that constraint of an office. And so you would think when, you know, the barrier sort of got bulldozed down for organizations who said, well, we can't work that way, or our industry that isn't set up to allow for remote work. Like we were able to call the bluff on all of that, right? Like whether or not it is, you're going to do it and you're going to figure it out. And I think just about every organization figured out a way for it to work because they had to. So that's probably a subject of an entirely different podcast, but a fascinating social experiment about how we can innovate when we have to do that. But then I think the assumption early was, well, you know, our Gen Zs are going to roll with us. Our millennials will be fine. Technology is no problem for them. They're able and used to working from anywhere. But wow, Gen Xers and boomers and in the traditional silent generation, we're all going to suffer and really have a tough time. And research is showing, it's still early, obviously, that we actually had that pretty backwards. And this has been fascinating to me. So I'm trying to dig into it from all different directions. But what happened, to simplify the story, is, you know, there was a learning curve on technology for everybody, but obviously, it probably took some of us a little bit longer. My students are so kind to me about Zoom. Like my Zoom links are wrong, like about 40% of the time. And they're just so kind to me about it. They may be judging, but they're not doing it vocally. I'm doing all right, but we figured it out, right? Like it was a little bit more like I did some tutorials with some colleagues who are older, like, okay, this is how you use Zoom. And I answered any question they have because my students taught me. And you know, we did the whole Gentelligence on technology thing. But once all of that got hammered out and people understood the tools they were supposed to use, then it got really interesting. Because older generations, in some ways, felt working from home, even though it was stressful, helped them balance their work and their life, whether they had kids, you know, that they needed to help do school, or older parents, or whatever it was. We were seeing that they reported they were doing all right. You know, obviously there's always roadblocks and things to get around, but the lowest levels of satisfaction with remote work were coming from our younger generations, not our older ones. And that was like a mic drop, right? Like what is this about? So I just started digging. Like some of it was anecdotal, and I realized that what we missed was that social piece, and not the I'm posting on Instagram social piece, but the fact that particularly when you're a Gen Z age or the younger of millennials, because our millennials are kind of spanning, you know, both the late 20s, which is still a sort of independent, you know, social time, and then 30s, which is can be a different animal. But so for our Gen Zs in particular, we'll say, work is where you meet your adult friends, right? Your first couple of years of work, you start making your contacts, your colleagues, your network, maybe your significant other. You go out with your work friends. There's social things happening through work. There's a lot of energy that comes from that connection of being around people and being in the office, quote unquote, as a, you know, at least an opportunity. And I think for people in older generations, we don't rely on work for the same social opportunities, right? We have our friends, we have our family for the most part, our friend group is established. And so maybe it was a challenge for us, but not nearly in the way it was for our Gen Z who rely on that. And so what we never thought about was, well, maybe they prefer getting to work from anywhere. But what happens when the office isn't even an option anymore? What kind of impact is that going to have? And I think dramatically on motivation. Work's not as fun because I don't get to see people.
work's not as interesting. There's not as many opportunities. Everything is just more complicated and takes longer. And so across the board and every, you know, these are mostly consulting group things and in surveys done, the academic research will take a little while to catch up to that. But we're seeing that our Xers, our boomers were for the most part doing all right and okay with remote work, and much more struggle happening from Gen Z and millennials. So I think to answer your last question about what do organizations need to do, I know they're trying. You know, I see all the LinkedIn posts for my students who get the onboarding basket of the t-shirt and the swag and like, you're doing a virtual internship. And like, I think that's a good start. I mean, I think you hit the low-hanging fruit. I do think they need to think about what did we lose and how do we get it back in a safe, responsible way, of course. You might have to use Gentelligence and ask the Gen Zers, right? Like, I think I would crowdsource that and say, what do you miss? And what are your ideas for getting it back, right? Like a Zoom happy hour is pretty limited. Nobody finds that super exciting anymore. But maybe it's a Netflix watch party where we're doing something non-work related that's still fun. Or I've actually even heard some great stories on a more serious note from Gen Zers who were able to retain their job offers, and the leadership of the company included them in the conversations about what the company was struggling with, what they were going to do strategy-wise moving forward, talk to them about the important role they were going to play in the future of the company, empowering them to help, you know, with the transition and make suggestions. So I think those are two different ideas, but I think certainly the idea of one going to the younger generations and asking them, like, what do you miss the most? I've heard a lot of new employees, so maybe the ones in 22 to 24, so that would be our oldest Gen Zs, saying, I know I can't go in the office, but I'd still like to, you know, move to Houston or move to Chicago so that I could at least maybe meet a colleague for a socially distant coffee, right? And so a lot of this was putting off even moving them to where the company was because of the expense and the safety. And some of them are saying, I got to feel like I'm in it, right? And what does that look like? And how can we use both technology, but also maybe some more tried and true things, even if it's small groups or, you know, masked meetings in the office, just to kind of get some of that normalcy back. I think they want it. I think that's what we're hearing.
The social connectivity is such a key part of organizational culture. And it is a struggle for businesses and organizations today to figure that out. But to your point, I do think organizations need to be okay with the fact that their culture may change and everything is changing right now. And so what our cultures were a year ago, 2 years ago, does not mean that it's going to be our culture moving forward. And you bring up a really good suggestion. Just asking, what do you need from a social connection point? And that could really open our eyes from an organizational level to think about what we could do in the future, because this challenge and struggle is not going to go away in the next 2 months, 3 months. We're looking at what are we doing for the next 18 months, 24 months? And again, that's 2 years. And we're looking at millennials and Gen Z being at least 75% of the workforce in 3 to 4 years. So this timeline is now. I mean, we have to start thinking about this now. And asking the question is a great suggestion for us to start that process and to be open to what the answer is, because the social connectivity is a very big part of where people gain their energy from, but also if they're going to stay at your organization, because there has to be some way that these younger generations feel that they're socially connected. And that is a challenge we're all going to need to figure out together. But Megan, you and I could talk for hours about this. I appreciate your passion around this and all of the perspective that you've gained and that you continue to share. I'm super excited to read the book when it comes out. It's pre-order now on Amazon. Again, the title is Gentelligence: The Revolutionary Approach to Leading Intergenerational Workforce. Could not be more timely and more appropriate as we are figuring this all out together. So, Megan, thank you for your passion in this area. Thank you for sharing your perspective and for spending some time with me today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I think, you know, if we can leave with one question, I think for older or younger generations, not being afraid to ask, well, how would you do it? I mean, I think there's no better form of connection in either direction that makes people feel appreciated and values what they bring to the workplace. So I encourage everybody to ask that question. I've loved getting to talk with you today. So thank you so much for having me.
Brilliant. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks.
And that was Be More, a podcast by Peakon. Be sure to search for Be More in Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, or anywhere else that you get your podcasts from. And go ahead and subscribe so that you don't miss out on any future conversations. On behalf of the team here at Peakon, thanks for listening.